And had the pleasure of having her at the STD conference for how many years now? A number of years. Amy is an assistant professor of sociology at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst and has really conducted what, at least in my mind, and I think in many, many people's minds, has been groundbreaking work on parent-adolescent interactions around sexual health, which has resulted recently in the publication of her book, Not Under My Roof, The Impact of Culture. Oh, sorry, that's the title of the talk. Not Under My Roof, just remember that buzz title because you're going to be hearing lots about this. This conversation at the past two STD conferences was extraordinarily instrumental in the minds of many in terms of how we think about sexual health in the U.S., and I think it stimulated huge, huge thinking in our field. So it's a tremendous pleasure to invite Amy back to address sort of a summary of her findings and where this work is taking us now. Dr. Shalit.
Thank you, John. It's wonderful to be back here and to both see the really exciting developments, all the words and the concepts and visions, especially as outlined by Meg previously. And at the same time, you know, we also see where we've been and what the research shows us, the questions that have been asked, the limitations. We see very little parent-teen communication, as shown just now by Jamie. And I come at this as a cultural sociologist. And what I want to do today is really take a closer look at what does normalization look like. So one of the objectives is to increase normalization of conversations about teen sexuality, and I'm going to focus on a case where we can really see what that looks like, and then also what is getting in our way within the United States of normalizing conversations about sexuality, especially adolescents. And finally, some thoughts about where we can go next, based on my research, but also based on a lot of media work I've actually done over the last year in disseminating my findings and getting feedback from a wide variety of audiences, and I want to share some of that with you. So this is the actual title of my book, Not Under My Roof, Parents, Teens, and the Culture of Sex, and the research that I'll present here comes from this book published by the University of Chicago Press, and I have several ways that you can contact me and learn more about the research if you want to hear more than you will today. I'm going to be very brief on methodological kinds of pieces because I'm wanting to get straight to the material and the arguments. But I'll just say that that this is a research comparing the United States and the Netherlands in terms of the ways in which teen sexuality is handled, especially in the home, but also in societies, in the two societies in general, and that it's based on 130 interviews with parents and teens, mainly 10th graders. Now, the title of the book refers to the leitmotif of the book, and namely the finding, hold your breath, if this is the first time you're hearing about it, don't freak out. It doesn't mean what you might think it means, but I will nevertheless tell you. So in the Netherlands, it is common for parents to permit older teenage couples who formed a relationship, which is considered committed often, even though they may be teens, to spend the night together in the same bed. Whereas in the United States, most parents say, no way, not under my roof, hence the title. Now, the implication of this research is often misunderstood, and it's often misunderstood in two ways, and I want to cut that right off at the pass. The Dutch families and what goes on in the Netherlands and is a form of normalization is not just a form of permissive parenting. There's, in fact, a great deal of conversation, a great deal of what I argue control, in fact, even more control and influence by parents over teenagers than is the case in the United States, where so much fear and secrecy and shame and stigma, the things we're trying to counter, are part of the sexual socialization of adolescents, that not just sex, but the conversation itself is driven outside of the home, as we just saw, which impedes parental control and communication. So that's the first thing I want to clarify. The second thing I want to clarify is the implication of the work is not that American parents need to go and permit sleepovers. This is not going to happen for many of the cultural reasons that I point out in my book. But the implication of the work is that it is possible for parents to normalize conversations, and that it has many different benefits. Benefits for the teens and their sexual health, but also benefits for the parents and for the relationship between parents and teens, and that this is possible. And I'll say a bit more about that as I move forward. So the first question is, why compare the U.S. and the Netherlands? And one graph kind of just gives it away sort of visually, though there's more to say. I just want to say a couple of things about this graph, which presents in blue the teen pregnancy rates and in green, sorry, the pregnancy rates and abortion rates and birth rates among U.S. teens, and in green the pregnancy, abortion, and birth rates among Dutch teens. Three quick things about the stats. These stats exclude fetal losses, which is why the pregnancy rate is lower than from the one you just saw in the previous presentation. This is all teens, but even if you just compare white teens, whose rates tend to be lower, you still see huge differences between the two countries that look very similar. And even if you take into account the recent declines which have taken place since the 2006, there are the strong international differences. But still, why compare the two aside from this? Well, first of all, they are both developed countries, which both went through the sexual revolution, and it's important to emphasize that. The Netherlands used to be very traditional with regard to sexuality. Sex before marriage was highly frowned on. Non-heterosexual sex was not accepted. And in both countries, as across the Western world, there was a sexual revolution that liberalized attitudes. And, of course, both countries have access to similarly advanced reproductive health technologies. But there are huge differences in adolescent sexual health outcomes, which I just showed you. One contributing factor is the differences in oral contraception and dual protection among teens. So among Dutch girls, 6 out of 10 girls are on oral contraception at first sex. And I always like to point that out, 6 out of 10 versus 1 out of 5 roughly in the U.S. That means that a young woman has anticipated first sex, has typically spoken to a parent, sought out a provider appointment, gotten on the pill before first sex. That's an indicator of a really different climate at home and in society in general that allows what we would call sexual agency, far less common in the U.S. There's also indicators that the experience of sexual initiation is different. So I'm not showing it today for time's sake, but you can find it in my book, that there are surveys showing quite high levels of ambivalence, feelings of regret, especially among young women in the United States about sexual initiation. In the Netherlands, little gender difference, and teens generally describe their first sexual experiences as fun, something else we're not allowed to ask about, right? Not just relationships. They generally describe them as fun, well-timed, and something that was within their control. In fact, about first heterosexual intercourse, young women, 85% of Dutch young women say, we were both equally eager to have it. So different experiences. And then finally, the different approaches. And I'm going to kind of jump right in there to illustrate the different approaches. But before I go into, I'll start with the Dutch case and the normalization of adolescent sexuality in the Netherlands. I want to say that one of the things that makes this research interesting is that I captured in the data that generation in the Netherlands that went through the transition. The parents who themselves were raised pre-sexual revolution or during, and then had to figure out how to normalize conversations within the home and handle things differently. And there was a strong motivation among this generation to move away from the kind of secrecy and shame around sexuality that they had themselves experienced. And yet there wasn't a new template. Things had to be figured out. And so that is interesting from the perspective of where we are today in the U.S. and moving forward. So the three parts are first to illustrate the hows and the whys of normalization of teen sexuality. How does it happen in Dutch families, and what does it get us from the perspective of sexual health? Second, to illustrate the inadvertent process of dramatization, which happens in the United States, the emphasis on the dangers, conflicts, and its costs. And finally, I'm going to discuss some of the lessons learned from my own experiences in public communication on the book. Before delving into the cultural side of the story, I'm just very briefly want to mention that when we do look at the differences in sexual health outcomes, we cannot forget the very important differences in provisions by the states to counter poverty, to provide health care, to provide income supports that we have in the Netherlands, which, since the syndemic, poverty and so many sexual health problems go together, this is a very critical piece in explaining the differences between the two countries. But there is also the cultural piece, because just because you have services doesn't mean that young people feel they can access them, that they're able to. So how does culture play a role? I want to just say two things about my conception of culture. We've heard a lot about culture in the presentations today, and often we think of it in terms of values. Now, part of culture is explicit values, but part of it is also the ideas we take for granted, the assumptions. And some of the ideas that we take for granted in the United States about teen sexuality are not necessarily our values, not necessarily what we want to be communicating, but what we do, even often in this field, the dramatization. The second piece I want to say is that in this presentation, I can only highlight national differences in culture, but there are, of course, many subcultural differences that need further exploration that I can't go into today. So I'm going to start with a little case that will illustrate the hows and whys of normalization. You're not going to be able to read it in the back, so I'm just going to read it to you. Few aspects of mothering two teenage daughters seem to faze Jolien Boskamp, a Dutch mother, a casually dressed part-time secretary who lives with her daughters and her husband Mark, a salesman, on the outskirts of Eastern City. That their eldest daughter Nathalie regularly spends the night together with her boyfriend Rob in their modest middle-class home is not something that Jolien regards as problematic. Jolien told Nathalie long before she met Rob, if you are ready, er aan toe, say it honestly and use the pill in any case. Jolien had been very clear, if you're ready, not with the first best person who comes along, you can only give it away once, give it to someone about whom you think this is the one. Jolien knows that Rob might not turn out to be Nathalie's only one, but she trusts her daughter and she has confidence in the relationship. Nathalie is just the kind of child that is so open and honest and sensible, almost like an adult, that when Rob slept over, well, for me it was really a matter of course that they would sleep together. But that Rob would spend the night in his home was not a matter of course for her husband, Mark. Nathalie was 16 and had been in a courtship with Rob for a couple of months when her father asked her, are you going to bed with Rob? Natalie was indignant. What do you think of me? I need to have been in a courtship a little longer to do that. At that time, Natalie had started spending the night at Rob's house. But for a while, Natalie and Rob just slept together, sleeping literally, her mother knows. Yolene was impressed. You would think, as she'd been crazy about him for years, that the first best time as a figure of speech, you'd say, let's do it. But no, it really took a few months. But at a certain point, you can't hold back those feelings. And then it goes further. At a certain point, things did go further. Natalie wanted Rob to spend the night with her at home. Absolutely not, was Mark's first response. Yolene played a mediating role. She told Natalie, Rob is your boyfriend. You two want to sleep together. It's all right with me. It's not all right with Papa. Therefore, you will need to talk about it with Papa. Natalie questioned her father's objections. She didn't let him off the hook when he claimed that Rob's presence would make it impossible for him to feel free in his own house. You don't have a problem with a girlfriend sleeping over, she said. Mark had to fight the battle on two fronts. When he told his wife, I wasn't allowed to sleep with you either when we were younger, she retorted, are they supposed to do penance for that, you know, if you put it that way, that you weren't allowed to sleep with me? At the same time, Yolene sympathized with her husband. He was confronted with a fact that he was not really ready to be thinking about. He saw Rob as an intruder, which he did not feel with her girlfriends, because Rob was a boy who had a relationship with his daughter, Yolene explains. Well, it is his daughter, his honor, his oldest. But that's history. For the past 9 months, Rob has spent the night in their house, and Mark doesn't have any problems with it anymore. No, no. So what does this show us? Normalization has three features. The first piece is that it links being ready very closely to contraceptive use, as you saw that in how Yolene talks with her daughter. The concept of being ready encourages self-knowledge, pacing, not jumping on top of each other right away when you have the first opportunity, and planning in advance. Use the pill in any case. The second, and this is important, it links sex and emotion, lust and love. So while in the United States, one reason we don't have more indicators of emotional health in relationships is that both in the popular imaginary and in our research, we don't really link sex and relationships in quite the same way that the Dutch do, and which makes the normalization a lot easier. If you are able to view teenagers as capable of falling in love, of having mutually healthy relationships, then it is easier to normalize. And finally, it shows that normalization isn't something that just exists, that it's a process whereby parents have to negotiate discomfort and conflict, and that Mark had to, you know, engage with his own feelings. He had to work it through. The key piece, though, is that the conversation remained intact, that there wasn't the moving outside of the family to avoid addressing discomfort. And as a consequence, what you establish, and this is a key concept, is control through connection. Control through connection. So parents are able to maintain connection, give advice, and give their perspective, and exert a certain amount of control through connection. I'm going to skip the story. Again, you'll have to read the book. It's a great story of a Dutch case, U.S. case, and I'm going to go straight to the features of dramatization. It tends to emphasize sex as an overwhelming force, and this makes it often difficult for young people to develop positive narratives about mastery and control and pleasure, so that it's often the story of it just happened. Why did it happen, especially for girls? That is difficult. It also doesn't recognize that for many males to whom we truly attribute the raging hormones out of control, oftentimes Intimacy plays a very big role, that I found U.S. males to be just as likely to express romantic desires as Dutch boys, even though Dutch boys are culturally expected to, whereas U.S. boys are not. And finally, the U.S. dramatization emphasizes the separation between family and sexuality. You have to first move out of the house, prove yourself an independent being, financially self-sufficient or married. And this has several different problems. Not only is it, of course, difficult in this day and age to establish financial self-sufficiency, as Eli said, we keep postponing it further and further, and certain groups find it difficult to establish it at all. But especially for girls, I found what I call sort of a bifurcation between the role of the good daughter and sexual development. Many girls that I interviewed in the U.S. had close relationships with their parents, had the kind of connectedness that we know is essential for health, not just sexual health, but found that it was difficult to address sexuality and to maintain closeness as they developed romantically and sexually. And so you get this separation of the good daughter on the one hand and sexual development, and the creation of a psychic burden of fear of disappointment and shame. What are the takeaways? I've had the often pleasure of communicating about this work with many different audiences, and I want to talk with you a little bit about the three themes that I've tried to communicate most strongly, and for which I have found an interest and a receptiveness. The first is really very simple, which is that teens can learn to understand pace and have control over their sexual decision making, and the terms we use play a role in whether or not we can acknowledge that. So I encourage, especially among professionals, the use of the word development, sexual development. Also the recognition that sexuality is a continuum of feelings and behavior, so that we're not just always talking about the sex act, which we don't want people to do at 14, but there's other things that they can do. And that really it's only by exploring that you're going to gain mastery over your sexual decision making. And this, incidentally, can be reconciled with religious values that that would prefer sexual intercourse that only take place within marriage. Young people still have to develop a sense of mastery with regard to their choices around dating and kissing and so forth and so on. The second message that I found to be really one that crosses the political spectrum is that we need to talk more about relationships. Everyone says yes to that, so I'll just not deepen that one. And since my time is up, I'm just going to harp home again a piece of the why. Open dialogue around sexuality and relationships strengthens the parent-teen relationship. I again found that talking to audiences, including very conservative audiences, that the concept of control through connection, maintaining an open conversation, and therefore you will have more influence, and therefore you'll be able to have more impact, to be one that really resonates. And so I would encourage you all at CDC to use that one as well. Thank you.